the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network presents Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis. Each week, Joan brings you news from inside the Vatican and the Church around the world, as well as interviews and answers to your questions. Now, here's the host of Vatican Insider, Joan Lewis.
Greetings from Rome, and welcome to Vatican Insider on this splendid Easter Sunday weekend, Easter of the Resurrection, the exaltation of this day that follows the passion and death of Jesus, the Son of God, who died for us, to redeem us, to give all of us a second chance at paradise. In the interview segment this weekend, I present part two of a special I've prepared on a piece of cloth linked to the resurrection, a piece of linen called the Shroud of Turin that many believe to be the cloth that wrapped the body of Christ in the tomb. I look at the Shroud's journey from the Holy Land to Turin, Italy, and examine the findings of scientists who have studied the Shroud for years in attempts to date it and link it to the burial of Jesus Christ. A fascinating and in many ways a miraculous story. Stay tuned for that after the news segment. Part one aired last weekend. Now, let's look at some of the week's top news stories. And it's a short weekly news report because EWTN shortens work hours for all of us on Holy Thursday, and we have Friday off to participate in Good Friday liturgies. Sunday, April 13th. On Palm Sunday, well over 20,000 pilgrims were overjoyed to see Pope Francis make a brief appearance at the end of Mass in St. Peter's Square, circulating for about 10 minutes among the faithful and the cardinals in their scarlet vestments carrying giant woven palms. The Vatican had been saying for some time that the Pope's appearance at Holy Week events would be determined by his doctors and by the weather. The Holy Father still has pneumonia, which is being treated as he convalesces in the Santa Marta residence. He has, however, delegated a number of cardinals to preside at liturgical events from Holy Thursday through Easter Sunday, although he is known for his surprise, unannounced appearances. Palm Sunday was, in fact, Pope Francis's fourth outing in a week. Last Sunday, he surprised those attending the Mass of the Jubilee of the Sick by appearing in St. Peter's Square. Thursday, he made an unannounced visit to St. Peter's Basilica, and Saturday, he went to pray before the icon he loves at St. Mary Major Basilica. In the Pope's Palm Sunday homily, read by Cardinal Leonardo Sandri, who presided at Mass, Francis called on the faithful to reflect on the Lord's compassion that knows no limits, to reflect on how we are meant to carry our own cross during Holy Week and help others all around us who bear the cross of suffering. He recalled how on Palm Sunday we remember the crowds who greeted Jesus with festive joy as he entered Jerusalem, and then only a few days later, when Jesus would leave the city condemned and bearing the cross on a path of pain and sorrow. Monday, April 14th was quiet in the Vatican, but Tuesday, April 15th, Vatican News, in a report on the Holy Week liturgies in the Vatican, noted that Pope Francis has been writing the meditations for this year's Way of the Cross at the Colosseum on Good Friday evening. Also April 15th, in a chirograph published on Tuesday, entitled The Petrine Ministry, Pope Francis renewed the academic program for the Pontifical Ecclesiastical Academy that prepares the Holy See's diplomats for their work. This academy for over 300 years has trained generations of priests who have placed their vocation at the service of the Petrine Ministry by serving in the papal representations and the Secretariat of State. The new academic program aims at providing a solid and ongoing formation to enable papal representatives to carry out their diplomatic mission to countries around the world and to face the challenges of a constantly changing world, to ensure the fundamental qualities of attentive listening, witness, fraternal approach, and dialogue, ever present in those who serve in the nunciatures. The aim, according to a statement from the Holy See, is to provide the students, young priests from dioceses all over the world, with a complete and suitable preparation for the diplomatic mission entrusted to them by the Holy See. The statement goes on to explain that the program of formation proposed for future pontifical representatives combines theoretical skills with an approach to work and a lifestyle capable of guaranteeing a profound understanding of the complex dynamics of international relations. Wednesday, April 16th, in a room behind the Paul VI Hall, the Holy Father received a group of doctors and staff from Rome's Gemelli Hospital, along with members of its affiliated university and structures, to show his gratitude for the medical care he received for 38 days for a polymicrobial respiratory infection and bilateral pneumonia. He was released from Gemelli with protected discharge on Sunday, 23rd of March. After a greeting from the president of the board of directors of the Gemelli Foundation, along with Easter wishes and hopes for the Pope's continued recovery, the Holy Father expressed his own gratitude to them, assuring them of his prayers and asking them to pray for him in return. "Thank you for the service at the hospital. Very good. Keep it up," he concluded. Also, April 16th, in Pope Francis's prepared catechesis for the weekly general audience, he wrote that he was pausing his series of catecheses on encounters Jesus had in his ministry to look at some parables, saying parables are stories that draw on images and situations from everyday reality. They touch our lives, and they ask us, "Where am I in this story?" "Let us begin," he said, "with the most famous parable, the one perhaps we all remember from when we were children, the parable of the father and the two sons. The prodigal son who left the family household seeking adventure, and the son who remained loyal to his father." Pope Francis reminded us that the father goes out to meet the prodigal son without scolding or lecturing him. He just wants him to feel loved. And therefore, said Francis, he invites him in and leaves the door open. "This gospel, this parable," said Pope Francis, "is a message of hope because it tells us that no matter how or where we've gotten lost, God always comes looking for us." Well, what a beautiful message for us in this Holy Week. And on that note, I end the news report and invite you to stay here for my special, Who is the Man of the Shroud? Have a blessed, beautiful, and spiritually uplifting Easter of the Resurrection.
This is Dale Alquist. When G.K. Chesterton was asked why he became Catholic, he said, "To get rid of my sins. Only the Catholic Church can do that." He said that when a man steps out of the confessional, he's 5 minutes old and his whole life has just started over again. When we confess our sins, our souls are wiped clean. We get to start all over again.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
I did not grow up religious. This morning, as I was chaotically driving around looking for a COVID testing site, I actually saw your radio station on somebody's car in front of me. Something told me to listen up, and so I switched up to the station and just started listening. And now here I am on the phone talking to you guys.
To ask, "Why should I pray?" is the same as asking, "Why should I raise my mind and heart to God?" since that's what prayer is. But when stated like that, it's pretty obvious. We need to pray because God is He to whom our minds and hearts are ultimately directed. Union with Him is our ultimate destiny. Without prayer, we lose our direction to God as our ultimate end, and thus set ourselves on a path that leads back into the slavery of sin.
Welcome back to Vatican Insider. Here's Joan Lewis.
Welcome to part two of my account of the Shroud at Turin, believed to be the linen cloth that wrapped the body of the crucified Jesus during his 3 days in the tomb. Last weekend, I looked at its journey through time and history and mentioned just some of the many tests done on this cloth since Secondo Pia took his famous photograph in 1898, a photo whose negative of a negative became a remarkable positive and reopened the case for the authenticity of the Shroud. Now looking back in a moment in the history of the Shroud. In 1578, St. Charles Borromeo, Archbishop of Milan, expressed the desire to venerate the precious relic of Christianity, but because of frail health, could not cross the Alps from Italy for the arduous trip because, of course, at the time it was in France. The Duke of Savoy, Emmanuel Filiberto, shortened the Archbishop's trip by bringing the shroud to Turin in May of that year. It has been in Turin for the past 437 years, except for the brief periods when it was removed to protect it from the dangers of war. For years, the shroud was wrapped widthwise around a wooden spool and housed in a silver reliquary above the main altar of an exceptionally beautiful chapel of black and gray marble designed by the Baroque architect Guarino Guarini. The chapel, especially designed for the shroud, is next to the Cathedral of St. John and is a masterpiece of architectural daring with an extraordinary dome of interlacing arches culminating in a gilded sunburst. At present, the shroud is kept flat inside an aluminum and glass case at a constant temperature in an atmosphere of argon gas. It is covered by a drape, embroidered with words in Latin that mean, "We revere your holy shroud, O Lord, and through it we meditate on your passion." On numerous occasions since 1898, when Secondo Pia photographed the shroud, including the 1969 appointment of a Roman diocesan commission to study the linen, photographs using techniques vastly superior to those of 1898 have been taken all upon special appointment and with the permission of its then legal owners, the House of Savoy, and now the Holy See. With these constantly improved photographs, the studies of the shroud multiplied and intensified over the years, involving many nations and many men and women. In the early 20th century, Dr. Pierre Barbet, a Paris surgeon and forerunner of today's syndonologists, that is, experts on the shroud, completed tests on cadavers to parallel the findings with what he, quote, read in the life-sized photographs of the crucified man. Joining him were Paul Vignon, a French biologist, and Yves Delage, a member of the Academy of Science in Paris. Later, Giovanni Giudica Cordiglia, degreed in medicine at Turin and in law at Pavia, and a professor of legal medicine in Milan, devoted his life and talents to the study of the shroud in yet another effort to arrive at its authenticity. Modern scientific investigative techniques were also used by the late Max Frey, for years a criminologist with the scientific police in Zurich, Switzerland, by Ian Wilson, a graduate student of history at Oxford University, by Reverend Morris Green, British priest and historian, and Father Peter Rinaldi, a Turin-born priest who at one time was vice president of the 7,000-member Holy Shroud Guild in the United States. Now, these few names are only the tip of the proverbial iceberg when it comes to naming experts on the Shroud of Turin, but some of the earliest studies on the shroud have also been the most remarkable. Max Frey, the Swiss forensic expert, aided by photographic enlargements, studied the microsedimentations present on the fabric, and he identified pollens, indicating not only the shroud's likely provenance, but its itinerary in the years before it reached Turin. Over 30 specific pollens were named as belonging to plants in the Palestine area, Turkey, and Western Europe. Each plant, even now extinct ones, has its own specific pollen, distinguishable from all other plants and as individual as fingerprints. Frey's long voyages, arduous studies, and astounding results played a major role in lending credibility to the authenticity of the shroud. Ultraviolet photography was first used in 1969 by Giovanni Battista Giudica Cordiglia, the son of the famed professor of legal medicine. This method, frequently used by police and art experts, traces organic substances which, if present on a tissue and illuminated by a mercury lamp, emit fluorescences that show up on the special photographic plates. Ultraviolet photography aids in neutron activation analysis and the evaluation of the origin of fibers and organic substance on these fibers, and it was instrumental in Max Frey's incredible findings. American contributions have been significant over the years. Dr. Donald Lynn of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, used enhanced photograph and aided image techniques, similar to those employed when the American spaceship Viking sent photos back from Mars. With the aid of a scanner, the markings on the shroud were broken down into a series of microscopic dots, and these in turn were translated into a mathematical code. The codified dots were then fed into a computer whose multiple readings provided information on the composition of the fabric, organic substances on its surface, and last but not least in importance, an electronically enhanced image of the entire shroud. Now, the enhanced photograph technique in the case of the shroud gave a three-dimensional effect. Simply put, it's much like listening to a Beethoven symphony in stereo. Nothing new is added to the original music, but its value is now enhanced. With the shroud, the original images were reinforced. In the 1970s and 80s, Captains John Jackson, a physicist, and Eric Jumper of the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, used in their research both a microdensitometer and an image analyzer, the VP-8, which gave a third dimension, that of depth, to the photographs. Their process translated electronically the diverse light intensities of the photographs of the shroud into a third-dimensional image. Whereas normal photographs show light and shadow, theirs also showed depth, the distance of the shroud from various parts of the body, in an analysis of flat versus volume. These modern methods of photography and scientific laboratory analysis allowed the human eye to see what previously went unnoticed, and they confirmed beyond a doubt the authenticity of the shroud. Earlier accusations of a falsification by painting were destroyed, as, with painstaking slowness and precision, it was revealed that someone who wanted to forge this would have to have been erudite in modern photographic techniques in order to recreate the perfect negative image on the shroud. He would also have to have been skilled in medical sciences to have known about the process of blood plasma separation represented by the carmine color stains on the shroud. The late Monsignor Ricci, whom I mentioned last week as one of the foremost world's experts on the shroud, told me in our first conversation those many years ago that surgeons reconstructing what has been read in the many photographs confirmed the exactness of anatomical details. The state of rigor mortis is in perfect accord with the biblical description of Christ's crucifixion. Studies of the various blood flows revealed the crucified man to have been in positions both of relaxation and then of pulling himself up. Surgical experiments also revealed that if a body is nailed to a cross through the palm of the hand, the sheer weight of the body tears the flesh in a short time, thus offering no support. However, if a nail is placed through the wrist in the so-called desto space, the weight will be more easily borne for a longer period. In addition, the carpus area of the wrist contains the median nerve, a highly sensitive motor nerve, and if a nail is hammered into this nerve, it causes the thumb to bend inward toward the palm. This fact shows up on the hand imprints of the man on the shroud, where only four fingers are visible. Close study also revealed that the legs were slightly bent and that only one nail was used to pierce both feet, evidenced again by the flow of blood. This nail allowed the crucified man upward movement, and both wrist and feet wounds showed he was alternately in a position of relaxation and of upward movement, thus avoiding death by suffocation that would have occurred had he remained only in a hanging position. For years, the most debated point was the exact cause of death of the man of the shroud. The strong arguments against the death by suffocation seemed to offer, on the one hand, conclusive proofs for death by infarction and hemopericardium, that is, the breaking of the heart. Monsignor Ricci's intensive studies were based on a theory put forth in the mid-19th century by an English physician, William Stroud. Dr. Stroud's research was favored by the fact that autopsies could be performed in England as soon as 2 hours after death, whereas on the continent, there was a mandatory interim of 48 hours. Basing his studies on St. John's Bible passage, quote, "and immediately there came out blood and water," quote, referring to the soldier's lance piercing the side of Christ 2 hours after his death, Stroud proceeded to prove that had the heart been undamaged prior to death, the blood and water, the plasma, would have flowed out mixed together in a single liquid. Whereas, in a previously ruptured heart, the blood would already have separated into two elements, the red corpuscles and the plasma. Thus, the hypothesis, based on the biblical eyewitness accounts and supported by actual autopsies, of a ruptured heart. The intensive mental anguish of Gethsemane that caused Christ to sweat blood even before his ordeal, the extreme shock caused by multiple scourge marks, there were over 120 separate lashes deeply inflicted, and these can be counted by blood marks on the shroud. The pain and the loss of blood through flagellation and the crowning with the helmet of thorns all combined to cause heart failure. Christ's loud cry at the moment of death, utterly impossible in the case of suffocation, announced the moment of rupture. Modern cardiology supports the theory that extreme moral stress can precondition the body for heart attacks and that, given even minor physical provocation, the heart will give in to this stress. While archaeologists, scientists, doctors, and theologians have probed, read, analyzed, and interpreted the shroud to determine its authenticity, artists have played their role in determining its provenance and suggesting the identity of the man in the shroud. In the first centuries after Christ, artistic representations of the cross depicted Christ as a fish. Its letters, spelled out in Greek, mean Jesus Christ, Son of God the Savior. They also depicted him as a lamb. The figure of Christ man on the cross was non-existent. Slowly, however, in the post-Constantine era, when Christians were allowed more freedom of expression, crosses appeared with a toned-down, fully clothed Christ. Curiously, the Byzantine art of the 4th to 11th centuries brought a coherence to the art of the cross, depicting a bearded Christ, half-nude, suffering and nailed to the cross, suggesting that the shroud had been exposed in the Eastern world in that period and that artists portrayed what they saw on the shroud. Contemporary art in the Western world, however, still showed Christ fully clothed and usually beardless, thus providing a strong argument for the historians who quote the shroud as first appearing in the West only after 1204. In the magical encounters between the ancient relic and men of science, art, and theology, the greatest mystery today lies in the question, how did the bodily imprints get onto the linen? Now, two theories are prevalent. Perhaps Monsignor Ricci, referring to these theories, best answered when he said, where research ends, faith begins. For researchers, the imprints could have been caused by the powdered aloes and myrrh spread on the shroud in a temporary effort at preservation of the body prior to full burial. For the Jews, the quickening approach of the Sabbath allowed only hasty pre-burial rites. These substances could have had a chemical reaction due to vapors or body liquids and the dampness of the tomb, thus causing the imprints to surface. On the other hand, they could have been caused by an inexplicable release of energy, a microsecond burst of radiation scorching the surface of the cloth. To date, there has been no scientific proof that would give credence to this second theory. Outstanding, however, were the findings of Baimabolone and Rodante that would confirm the first theory as being scientifically irrefutable. Their repeated experiments proved consistent in their results. If a fabric impregnated with aloes and myrrh and in direct contact with a body covered with coagulated bloodstains was exposed to conditions of humidity or moisture, there would appear in approximately 36 hours bodily imprints identical in nature to those of the shroud. In 1988, a carbon-14 dating test was performed on scraps of the shroud, an independent test in laboratories in Tucson, Arizona, Oxford, Great Britain, and Zurich, Switzerland. Test results said the shroud dated from 1260 to 1390, which of course would rule out it being used during the time of Christ. However, tests done since then by scientists at the University of Padua in northern Italy used the same fibers from the 1988 test but disputed the findings. The newer examinations date the shroud to between 300 BC and 400 AD, which would put it in the era of Christ. Brendan Whiting, author of the 2000 book, The Shroud Story, introduced the world to the most powerful evidence that the 1988 Shroud C14 dating test was invalid. Most recent tests have determined that the earlier carbon dating test results were likely skewed by contamination from fibers used to repair the cloth when it was damaged by fire in the Middle Ages. In addition, there would have been contamination from the hands of the nuns used to repair the cloth. Now, the Catholic Church has never pronounced itself officially on the authenticity of the shroud or the identity of the man. Nor is it, quote, within the Church's doctrinal definition to declare the authenticity of any relic. Importantly, the Church has never denied its authenticity. Several popes have openly expressed reverence for the shroud, and Pope Pius XI dedicated a prayer to it. In September 1936, he said, "There is still much mystery surrounding the sacred object, but it is certainly sacred as perhaps no other thing is sacred. And assuredly, one can say this as an acknowledged fact, even apart from all ideas of faith or Christian piety. It is certainly not a human work." Paul VI said, "Perhaps only the image of the shroud gives us something of the mystery of this human and divine figure." More recently, Pope Francis and his predecessor, Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, both described the Shroud of Turin as an icon, and St. John Paul called the shroud a mirror of the gospel. Hundreds of scholars from a variety of fields have spent hundreds of thousands of hours and millions of words researching and writing about the shroud. This could be a book-length account if it were to include mention of only a score of these scholars. The question remains, who is the man of the shroud? The answer has been almost unanimous since experiments done following Secondo Pia's photograph in 1898. Syndonologists, experts on the shroud, some even previously atheists, have paralleled their findings with the evangelical account of the death of Jesus, and they conclude that scientific, objective evidence proves the man to be Jesus. When asked if he believed the man of the shroud was Christ, Monsignor Ricci told me years ago there was perfect agreement between the gospel account of the death of Jesus and the story told by the shroud. He said, "If one had recourse to the gospel, the document of faith, and to a careful reading of the Holy Shroud, the archaeological document, you see that both speak of Christ with unmistakable certainty."
For more information on these stories, or to check out Joan's blog and to ask her a question, go to EWTN.com. That's EWTN.com. Thanks for listening to Vatican Insider on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.